WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're back in the home studio here. If you've seen Governor O'Malley out on our Baltimore Positive, you've seen any of our Maryland Hospital Association chats from down in Annapolis. Right now, we are focused on the 7th Congressional District. It's a little weird. The timing of it's weird, right, Don Mohler? I mean, we try to activate people to vote anytime. It's hard to do, right?
But we have Senator Jill Carter. Your head must be spinning, Senator. I keep saying to folks, let me see. February 4th, there's an election. No early voting. April 28th, there's an election. And then November the 3rd. Have you ever seen anything like this, Senator?
Not that I recall, but I know it existed because it happened when Elijah won the election, special election in 1996.
Well, you know, I know all of you are working hard. Before we get into the election, I know that you were, I think you, were you the third African-American female elected to the state Senate?
To the Maryland legislature.
Maryland legislature. You were the third. So I want to ask you this week, when Senate President Bill Ferguson really made history by unveiling the portrait of Senator Verda Welcome, tell us and our listeners what that moment felt like to you as an African-American female.
Well, I felt extremely pleased that President Ferguson understood that it was important to do, understood that it was important to modernize and diversify the walls of the Senate chamber. Now, when I was in the House of Delegates, I was not the only one, but I was one that had led an effort to remove the Taney statute. And one of the things that was troubling to me as to why, you know, Speaker Bush, at that time, Speaker Bush and President Miller were very resistant to doing it. And as you know, later on when Governor Hogan came in and the episodes happened in Virginia, and there became kind of a movement across the country to remove those types of statutes, then suddenly, you know, they were able to get it done. But when I had testified and, you know, made the plea that I often felt unwelcome in the legislature and said that the statute was, for many of us, a reminder of a time when we were not legally even treated as human beings.
Senator, remind that for our listeners. Not everybody might know who Justice Roger Brooke Taney was. Give them a quick history lesson, because we like to do that on Baltimore Podcast, about who he was and why it bothered you.
Well, he was a Marylander, and many people thought he was in some ways a great and heroic Marylander. But for me, the significance is that he was a justice of the Supreme Court at the time when the Dred Scott case was heard, and it was his opinion that Dred Scott opined that a black man was three fifths of a human.
Correct.
And basically the line that stood out for me was that a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. And what was significant for me in terms of being in the House of Delegates is I often felt that I was not that was the culture that was there too often. I championed a lot of issues of justice, fairness, and equality, and I often felt that there was no respect or no belief that I had a right to have respect. And that was troubling because I wasn't just there for myself. I was there representing people that elected me. And I did not think that was an appropriate way to treat a legislator. But moving on.
Your family, I mean, you have a long history of fighting for civil rights in your family, right? Your dad, educate, as folks are getting to know the candidates, talk about the history of your family in this struggle.
My dad was Walter P. Carter. He was well known as a civil rights activist. I like to say civil rights hero or icon. He was a person who at times worked with different organizations. For example, there was a time when he was a local president of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. He led protest efforts and desegregation efforts across Maryland. He's well known for a lot of work with housing desegregation, fighting for fair and affordable housing. His last fight of his life was notoriously against Morris Goldsecker, who at the time was, you know, considered one of the worst predatory lenders to the black community in Maryland. And he died when I was young. And when he died, I felt like, because he was away a lot, he was not at home a lot, you know, he's always like meeting, protesting, doing something. And my mother would tell me, you know, that he wasn't home because he was, you know, fighting for liberation or fighting, you know, for freedom. And when he died, I said, you know, who's going to do that now? Who's going to fight for liberation and freedom now? Just the way I internalized it as a little girl. But I believe I really internalized it because I always, throughout the course of my life, felt an obligation and a responsibility to pick up where he left off, whatever I saw on something I felt was unfair or unjust. I've always been inclined to want to do something to change it.
So, I mean, obviously, being empowered and going to Congress, right? I mean, and the large shoes of Elijah Cummings. But more than that, these issues you bring up that are fundamental core issues, these are the same issues we're still fighting about. And certainly the impeachment process and everything that's going on. You mentioned Charlottesville and recent memory. Yeah, we have Congress people that, you know, of your gender and of other religious backgrounds that are being flogged by the President of the United States in 2020. So, you know, obviously going down to Congress, some thoughts about the power of that and what you could bring from the 7th down to D.C.?
Thanks for asking the question. So, also when I was a little girl, the first campaign I remember was the campaign for Karen J. Mitchell, who was the first black congressman for the 7th District. And he meant a lot to people. He meant a lot to the community. And his type of representation was that of being independent of the leadership and fighting for what was right and always putting constituents first and justice. And you know, he gave people hope and people trusted him. And he's an example for me of what a representative should be, someone that can be trusted. And so I feel that with everything that's going on locally and nationally, people are losing trust in elected representatives because of the corruption, because of everything that's been going on recently. And I, first of all, I always campaign, even now, as a servant of the people. And I say that because, you know, you may not know, but, you know, I've never been heavily funded by political establishment, by, you know, high corporate donors. Now I'm not taking corporate PAC money or fossil fuel money.
Senator, you're singing Nestor's song there. You know, you understand.
I'm tired of hearing of the money.
You're touching his heartstrings.
Well, this is the reason you're on right now. I'm a sportscaster for 30 years, and, you know, I'm fed up, and I'm fed up with the money, and I'm fed up with the buy-off, and I'm fed up with the Russian mafia running our country. And, you know, I mean, and I'm fed up with a president that would disparage Elijah Cummings, disparage my town, and I'm fed up with a mayor that's going to prison. So that's how this was birthed. That's why you're here, because it's time to act. I'm 51 years old. I'm not on the sidelines anymore.
And building on that then, Senator, let's really look into that. You're saying I'm not taking corporate money, never been a big fan. Can someone in this day and age, can you be elected to Congress? I'm going to just cut to the chase. Can you be elected to Congress without doing that?
Clearly, I think so, but it is definitely an uphill battle, and it would be a real signal that it is possible if I get elected, because I'm sure that the other front runners in the race are, you know, heavily financed, nationally financed. And, you know, so campaign finance and the need to fundraise astronomical amounts of money is the cancer underlying all the other cancers in our political system. And the reason that I say that is it's the reason, first of all, the fact that a candidate is not even considered viable if the candidate is a regular person that gets regular money from regular people in small amounts that add up to something they can put out some literature with. You know, pundits, media, everybody only considers candidates viable when those candidates have high, well-known, high-level donors and high-level contributions. That is really what is wrong with our system. We should be able to be financed by the people that we represent. That way, they are the only ones that have any power and influence over us. When we're donated to by what I call is corporate donors, owners, and controllers, then that's the reason that we have such a corrupt system.
I'm going to have to let you and
all these people that don't represent their constituents.
I'm going to have to let you. I'm going to have to let you and Nestor talk among yourselves, because you are hitting every one of the themes that he literally brings up every week.
It really grosses me out to know that foreign people are getting involved at the highest level. But then, you know, at the local level, when I hear this, I saw the report this week, literally, about the mayor's race and who has the most money, and that's the shell game of how you win. And I'm also kind of appalled at what you do with the money, right? You get all of this money, you literally just give it to a couple television stations who are then one way or another charged with holding you accountable. So, I'm grossed out by all of it. Jill Carter's here. She's trying to fix it. She's going down to D.C. if she wins in the 7th District. We're talking to so many congressional...
She calls herself the People's Champion.
It's like those are fighting words, Jill.
The People's Champion.
You're 41. Tell me what you're proud of in 41.
Okay, so I'm older than that, so I don't know what information you have.
No. District 41.
I'll take 41.
You can say I'd like to be 41 again. 41. But I represent.
I would not like to be 41 again, but I would like to look like I did.
But Nestor's saying, what are you proud? What have you done in 41 that makes you proud that you then say to somebody in the 7th, look what I've done. I can do this for you on a bigger stage.
Well, the bill that I put in last year that, you know, got a lot of attention, which was the bill that shook up the University of Maryland medical system, and it gave birth in the public arena to the Healthy Holly story. And it wound up, like, causing the president of the University of Maryland medical system and all of the board members to either step down or be removed. And it exposed the fact that they were self-dealing in multi-millions of dollars. Instead of putting it out to the public or an open, transparent procurement process, they were using their position on the board to benefit themselves financially. And that was unacceptable when they got, you know, tons and tons of state dollars to function. And of course, the whole situation with Healthy Holly. So I think that's the most recent example of the type of legislator that I am and the type of representative that I am, that I believe very strongly that government should be open and accessible to people and transparent and accountable to people, not just a place for people to enrich themselves.
Senator, what made you, and a lot of our listeners, a lot of our viewers may not know, that you really were on the front end of the whole issue with the University of Maryland and the Board of Trustees. What drew your attention? I mean, that situation had been going on for a long time. You know, Healthy Holly was happening, and it just was sort of taking place in plain view. What drew your attention to make you think something's not right here?
Someone complained to me that it was impossible for people to get contracts with whether it was for ambulance services, insurance, anything, because it wasn't open, and, you know, they knew about this Frank Kelly in particular was the highest profit, the biggest profiteer. What to me, it's a little bit unfortunate that all of the attention went to the Healthy Holly $500,000 deal, when the truth is the amounts of money that were lost to being open options for small businesses, minority businesses, to be able to participate in the process and benefit the larger community, where it was closed, people were excluded from it because these board members were just saying, okay, the University of Maryland needs $3 billion worth of transportation services. We're going to do that. I can do that. And whatever other services they needed.
So with you, it was really an issue of fairness and equity.
It was, but that's really, you know, that's the part that isn't being talked about. And the part that isn't being talked about is that the mayor didn't write checks to herself. Somebody wrote the checks. Somebody authorized the checks. It was a culture of corruption.
Well, you're out there talking about it now. So we've got openness. We got transparency. We've got you being this battler fighting against corruption. Let's talk about some of the other major national issues, because we think a lot of folks are going to pay attention to this. I was kidding with another interview that as we were doing it, I got a text from somebody and said, can you tell me where I can find out information on people running in the 7th? So take a big one that everybody's going to have to deal with, health care. Where are you? You go to Congress. What are you going to be fighting for in terms of health care for the nation?
Well, I've been very vocal that I do believe in Medicare for all, that I believe that people should not have the quality of people's health care should not depend on their employment or their income, that everybody has a right to have quality health care, and that Medicare is a system that works for older people. It also should be expanded to include, especially for older adults, long-term care, vision, dental, and that I believe we do it by widening its umbrella and including more people. And we transition into a system of universal health care like every other civilized nation.
All right, so you're a Medicare for all person. Tie that then to us for the effort also to fight opioid addiction in the United, because it seems to me they go hand in hand. So as a congressman, what's the federal government's role in taking on this awful opioid crisis?
Jill, you'd be a congresswoman, by the way. I'm just
congresswoman,
okay.
Right.
Yeah, I would. Hopefully I'll be the first congresswoman.
Congresswoman, right.
Where I was born and raised. And so let me just really quickly backtrack. So our congressional delegation has no women.
Right.
I do believe that if we are really for, you know, fair representation, equitable representation, we should have at least one woman in our delegation, and I would hope that would be me. The opioid is a healthcare issue, as to be quite honest with you, so was crack cocaine and cocaine, heroin. Drug addiction, the epidemic is always, the epidemic of people being addicted to drugs has always and should have been treated as a healthcare problem rather than a feeder into the criminal justice system and mass incarceration. But finally, you know, I do think there's a sentiment there to treat it as a healthcare crisis. And basically, people need treatment on demand, and they need to have the ability to get treatment and, you know, as it's needed, 24/7 treatment.
We met yesterday, Senator. Nestor and I did a number of shows with the Maryland Hospital Association, and folks from all over the state came, and they had a consistent theme that if you're going to get serious about addressing the opioid crisis, you better get serious about treatment on demand.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, because otherwise, you know, people that are addicted need immediate intervention when they need it. If they don't get it when they need it, then they're going to continue on that path, which, you know, we know the path leads to, like, death and destruction. And so we have to do that. So what is my role? Making sure that the resources are there, making sure that we have a funding mechanism in place to make sure we can take care of people that we need it. And, of course, coming from Baltimore, this is something that is critically important. You know, we have to be able to save people's lives, get them out of addiction, hopefully into some measure of productivity, because our city needs residents. We need people that are contributing to our tax base and the quality of life here and not taking away from it.
Jill Carter, member of the Maryland State Senate, representing District 4-1. She is running for the 7th in Congress, and lots of folks out there trying to replace Elijah Cummings. The election right around the corner. Special primary on February the 4th. Then we're going to have more elections in April, more elections in November. We've talked so much about police and crime and guns and murdered youth, and crime's going to be at the heart of the mayor's race, which we talk so much about
the
here.
Madness. We call it the madness.
The madness of all of it. And some thoughts for you on what you've seen in serving the people and guns in your community, and what that can happen when your text goes off and someone in your district's been shot, and it's happening far too often.
So it's horrible, because now we really do get texts every time, and it's constant. It's, you know, the cycle is just constant. The first thing I'll just say on a human level is it has a really bad effect on our mentality and our psyche and our spirit when we know that people are dying all around us. And frankly, I live in the city, of course, so I actually hear gunshots, you know, with relative frequency. And I'm always thinking, you know, who is getting harmed or killed now? It's terrible. I don't want to be too long-winded,
Please. We're Baltimore Positive. We got room for you. Go ahead. This is important. I live at the harbor. It's the most important thing we got going on. We had a guy shot in broad daylight 6 blocks from my house. I mean, that sounds like 6 blocks. Most people in the city are like, oh, I had one 3 or 2. That's crazy.
Yeah, what do we do, Senator?
Well, on a very basic level, I've thought about how I was as a child, and everything that I've ever done good has very little to do with me and everything to do with the people that were around me, making me believe that I had options. I had options. Like, I could go to college and become a lawyer, or I would, you know, something to have a good life. But when you're dealing with people that have been disinvested for a long time, that do not have, that for many, many years, in many communities in Baltimore City in particular, there's been absolutely nothing. There's been no job opportunities. There's been inadequate education and resources. The only economic engine in many communities has been the drug trade, the illegal drug trade for a long time. And so you're talking about people who, multi-generational, have been defeated and depleted. And there is no, you know, it's really important, like, even when it comes to addiction, I used to say, you know, how do you expect people to just get off of drugs and be sober when there's nothing for them when they're sober? Like, they sober up and they're still living in dilapidated houses with, you know, nothing but crime and grime all around them and no real options. And so what I think a solution that people in office can do is provide, how do you fix that? By reversing the trajectory. Sorry, I feel like I'm not even all the time. Reversing the trajectory. I'm trying to talk really fast. So how do you do that? By funding things like we're going to do in the state, you know, Kerwin, which is the blueprint for Maryland's future. And I know, you may be skeptical because we've heard all of this before. But I do believe that this time we're going to get it righter than we got it.
But we can't stop trying. Well, I mean, these people you know, the guy down on Apple that wants to shoot down Kerwin and make up these numbers and do fear-mongering to people out in the sticks about what it costs them to have a quality education, we can't quit on it, Jill. You know, I mean, that's the issue for me is if not that, then what? Because we're not going to stand still on this issue. We can't stand still. We're living here in the city. We got to do something.
It's one step in the right direction, but I understand people are saying, well, Kerwin is going to take 10 years to fully implement. Meanwhile, we have all these problems now. What are the quicker, more short-term solutions? One of them is one of the things that actually Governor Hogan began but needs to be expanded, which is his violence intervention prevention program funding. And we are working this session, myself and Delegate Brooke Learman, to expand the money. And what this is not your regular, just like, oh, you know, you fund a program and the CEO of the nonprofit makes $200,000 a year and for 6 months they put, you know, youth through training. This is more on the ground, funding the grassroots organizations and efforts in the community that are long-term entities to serve people, do wraparound services, meet their needs and that kind of thing. That's going to be very powerful, especially if we expand it. That's one of the things we do is prevention. You talked about guns. Of course, I do believe, as most of my, you know, fellow, like, brethren and sisters in the Democratic Party, at least in Maryland, believe in gun control and believe in universal background checks and all of the things that we need to do to try to stop people that are going to commit violent crimes from getting access to guns. But one of the things that they really ignore all the time is the idea that all the guns that are killing people in Baltimore, for example, they're not guns that were necessarily obtained legally. So a lot of that doesn't matter until we are able to trace these guns to the source of input. How so many are getting on the street? We're not going to really be able to fix the problem. So last year, I did have a bill that passed that was a study that would cause law enforcement, you know, when a gun is found in a crime, to trace the source of the gun. How did it get here? And why do I think that's important? Because I don't believe that, even we've said, like, in the past with the drug trade, like, you know, people in Baltimore in these neighborhoods, they don't have, like, you know, ships and boats and planes, and they have cars, many of them. But with the mass number of guns that are coming in, they're being put in. And whatever the source of that source needs to be cut off, as opposed to just, you know, constantly thinking that if we see a gun, we're going to, you know, lock up somebody that has a gun. A lot of people that live in these really high crime areas are, some of them are good people, and they feel that they have to have guns to protect themselves. So I don't think the solution is solely on getting rid of or criminalizing people for having guns. I think a solution is trying to find ways to prevent the influx of guns into the communities.
We are talking with Senator Jill Carter. Jill, we're going to give you the opportunity right now. We'd like to end, we'll say 30 to 45 seconds. All of the folks listening out there in the 7th, they're going to vote on February the 4th. Tell them in 30 to 45 seconds why the people's champion, Jill Carter, should go to Congress.
Thank you. So lots of candidates in this race, many of them are intelligent, many of them are good people, but only one has a track record of standing up, speaking truth to power, sometimes having to fight the political establishment as I did the entire time I was in the House of Delegates. I have passed more legislation than anybody in this race, including the former congressman, and that is significant because I did it having to fight tooth and nail for it because I was never one that was in favor with the leadership or political establishment. Even with this fundraising effort, I've always been relatively funded by the people. I've never been one that was, you know, the establishment just says, hey, let's pour money into this campaign to get her elected. So everything has been a struggle and a fight, and I've been battle-tested. And so if you want to know what somebody's going to do in Congress or anywhere, look at what they've already done. And in all of these years that I've been in the House of Delegates and now in the Senate, I've always stayed true to putting the constituents first, before the politics of the political establishment or any other special interest. My special interest is the people. So I would encourage everyone to choose me. Get Jill on the Hill is my motto.
Get Jill on the Hill.
I like it.
Because, so even Elijah Cummings called me the people's champion. That's why it keeps coming up. But,
the people's champion.
Last year,
I promised you, wasn't this more fun than call time?
Yeah, but I want to make a plug. So because I am funded by the people, if you like me, and you want me to get out this last-ditch mailer and cover polls on Election Day, you can go to my website, JillCarterForCongress.com, and make a minimal donation because I like a lot of small donations from a lot of different people.
There you go. Senator Jill Carter, thank our sponsors. We got Fadley's, Jennings, State Fair, Center of Maryland. They make all this possible. Jill, good luck. Thanks for running, we say to everybody. Thanks for getting in the game. Nestor Aparicio, February 4th, 2020. Democracy is
time
not...
Time to vote. Time to vote. It's not a spectator sport, Jill Carter. We'll tell you, I appreciate you. Keep giving them hell out there, all right? Get Jill on the Hill. There you go.
Thank you.
You got
Thank
it. Jill
you.
Carter joining us here. Former House delegates, now Maryland State Senator representing District 41. He's Don Moeller. I'm Nestor. We got a lot of great conversations ahead. Make sure you're checking out our chats with the Maryland Hospital Association from Annapolis, learning a lot about health care. We talked about the opioid crisis. Also had just an outrageously wide-ranging conversation with former governor and mayor Martin O'Malley, one of the best conversations I've done in 30 years of having these kind of conversations. We did that at Fadley. So lots of stuff ahead, including lots of representatives trying to represent us in the 7th Congressional District. It's quite the race we got going on February 4th. He's Don. I'm Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, and WNST Baltimore Positive. And we never stop telling great stories about making Baltimore better.